Hello, guys. Hi, it's Paddy here, and thank you once again, and as always, for downloading the It's Not All About Me podcast, a podcast featuring a guy with ME and a mic, and that's me, Paddy. This week, being, the fortnightly session, It Is Not All About Me again this week. I am really happy to say that I had a chat with John Peters this week. John, I've been actually trying to get on the show. I think we talk about this in the chat. I've been trying to get John on for, I think, since the show started. He was due to be the first guest. And then, you know, things had to be cancelled because I was ill, and then rebooked and cancelled because I was ill, and blah, 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 blah. And he's now finally on the show. And I'm really, really happy. As you can see, if you're looking at the show notes at the time, whenever you downloaded this or you're streaming this, we have quite a long episode. We had quite a really good long chat. I thoroughly enjoyed it. So I don't think I'm going to spend too much time chatting with you right now. I haven't silenced my phone, as you can tell. Deeply professional, as always. Guaranteed. And I am surrounded by, as I record this intro, I'm surrounded by four cats. And I know that they are just seconds away from, you know, starting to bleat and purr and then start messing with the wires, microphones and everything else that I have set up here. So I think I'm on borrowed time as it is, as far as the cat situation is concerned. So I think we'll just dive straight in. Thank you for downloading the show. Thank you for continuing to download the show. And I will chat to you at the end. But for now, here is the chat that I had with John Peters. Please enjoy. I certainly did. And we're here with John. John, hi, how are you doing?
Hello, Paddy. How are you? Yeah, I'm okay, thanks.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm doing good. Thank you for asking. It's been a long week. We're recording this on a Friday, and do Friday still mean something to you? Do you still get that Friday feeling whenever it's like, oh, the weekend's coming up?
No, nothing. I haven't for years. I have no sense of the days at all. The only strange thing is that I get the weekend free because I don't have any daily task to do, if you see what I mean, but that's just by coincidence. But I completely have no sense of that passing day at all.
Yeah. I think it's, I probably get the feeling more because living kind of through my wife, I think it's probably, I get that Friday feeling because it means I'm gonna have some company for a couple of days.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's probably why I still get that, that frisson of excitement and something to look forward to. But something I guess I have asked everybody whenever our conversation has started, how are you feeling today?
Okay, thanks. No worse than usual. I haven't had a bad week, actually. The one thing is that I, the illness for me is all viral. It's always been viruses. I do get other kinds of infections, and they take a little bit longer to get through as my body's not working properly. But the illness itself is connected to a virus, and I got another virus just over 2 years ago, January 2017, and I haven't got over that since. And it's kind of, I hope it's sort of going through the death throes over the next few months. But one of the symptoms of that is my eyes. So I've had a really bad eye ache all week. It's been really quite painful. But it's odd though, because it's in a sort of strange way. I think this could be a good sign because the virus is playing itself out a bit more, but it is a bit uncomfortable. But as far as being in myself is, it's not been a bad week. Thanks.
No, I'm glad to hear it. Very glad to hear it. So can we rewind back there? That's really interesting how you define quite clearly your illness. So can I ask, first of all, what do you call your illness?
This is quite interesting because I first got ill back in the 1980s, and my doctor diagnosed me. I got ill in December 1985. It was a virus. It was probably glandular fever. And then by sort of April, May, June, it was, okay, this is post-viral syndrome. And this was before, in fact, it was before chronic fatigue syndrome had been coined. And it was before much of the publicity about ME. So I had never heard of ME, and he called it post-viral syndrome. So I referred to it as post-viral syndrome then up until the sort of 90s, early 90s. And then I just decided that I'm going to adopt ME as a kind of, as a political statement, in fact, that this is not chronic fatigue syndrome. I have ME. But as I say, it has always been viral. So I wasn't, I know some people don't like post-viral syndrome because it suggests it's after the virus. But I've always been quite happy with post-viral syndrome. But as I say, I always use ME now.
I see. And I really like, and we will definitely come back round to you saying that was a political statement. I was kind of hoping, we were speaking before we came on air about how we have this idea of people because we exist a lot of the time on the online space as a result of our illnesses not letting us interact. And I think I have this idea that I was looking forward to speaking to you because I get the sense that you have something to say politically that I think if people have listened to my previous shows, I've expressed a nervousness or a caution that I don't feel comfortable diving into this arena. And I was kind of hoping that you might bring that up. I got the sense you might. So we will come back around to that. But just so I can get this right in my head, whenever you say that this is viral, what exactly do you mean by that? That you see your illness as viral?
Okay, well, first, as I say, that it started with the virus. Very clearly, I know from whom and when. It was December the 8th. It was my flatmate's Christmas party. I went for an 8-mile run in the morning. I didn't have anything to eat. We all got drunk. I copped off with a girl in the fishnet stockings. She wasn't feeling very well that day. We went off for a curry. We did a bit more snogging. She was too well to do, too unwell to do anything. And that was it. And we left it at that. The next day, I went to a party and got drunk again. And then on the Tuesday morning, I woke up and I was ill.
Right.
Except I just had this foggy head and I couldn't clear my head. And it was the last week of term and I just carried on getting drunk. We went off to the varsity match that day to watch the rugby. It was Tuesday, the 10th of December, 1985. So I know when and where that I got ill. Now, what happened after that is that I continued to live an active life. So I carried on drinking. And when I wasn't drinking, I was out training. I'd broken my arm, so I wasn't playing rugby that season. So I was probably overtraining a bit as a sort of compensation. And I'd lost the routine of my week. If I'd been playing rugby, then I would have been sober on the Tuesday to go training. And then I'd have realized that I had an illness or something. I wouldn't have been able to play on a Saturday. I'd have rested, etc. But I just went running. I can't clear my head. I'm going to go and run it off in the track. I can't clear my head. I'm going to carry on drinking, etc. So I certainly made myself ill on top of the virus. I didn't give my body the chance to respond to the virus. Now, something happened. I've always said this right back from the 80s. Virus plus activity. The virus went somewhere or it did something, and that is ME for me. So that's why I always say it's virus. And on top of that, I started to recover and then I got another virus and I did the same thing. I ignored it and I got worse. So each time I've had this virus, I've started to recover and I got another virus and it's made me worse. So again, it's always been viruses. And throughout this period, I have had a number of other infections. I had a really very bad period around the turn of the century when I spent best part of 5 years in bed, and all 3 years essentially. And I was just getting one infection after another. There was a yeast infection, a bacterial infection, I had pleurisy, I had a gallbladder infection. And these were bacterial infections, and it would take my body time to get over it. There was no question that my immune system was damaged. So it was picking up these infections and it was taking time to get over them. But they weren't affecting my ME. That's the thing. That's the crucial thing for me. That when I had these bacterial infections, they didn't affect my ME. Whereas every time I get a virus, I can sense that if I don't take it really carefully right from the beginning, it's going to go ME again on me. Now, what exactly the virus is doing is, of course, the big question. And I'm also not going to say that what I have, my experience is the same as everybody with ME. In fact, it's very clear to me that it isn't the same as everybody with ME. So I think that ME is more than one illness. I mean, this is quite apart from the sort of nonsense about chronic fatigue and all that. And some people clearly have other problems which are being diagnosed as CFS, ME or whatever. But I think all those people who have ME, the sort of genuine ME, I don't know whether that sounds, whatever you like to call it, I think there's at least, there's more than one illness in it. Whether that's different of the same illness or different illnesses, I don't know. So I'm only talking about my own experience here. But for me, it is entirely viral. And I think what happens is that because I didn't rest, the virus damaged my immune system. And for me, I don't know, my illness is mainly cognitive. Did it penetrate into the central nervous system? Was there a sort of minor low-grade infection? Minor low-grade, can't think of the word, that's the ME again, inflammation. Has there been some sort of is ME some sort of post-inflammation or something like that? I don't know, but that's how I've experienced it. Sorry, I went on there,
buddy. That is absolutely fantastic, and you were incredibly clear with that. So thank you very much. That's giving me massive food for thought. As you say, that's your experience. And it's interesting because I met with a doctor, and I spoke about this last week, and the doctor said to me about, I had a nice frank chat with him. I was quite tired, so I was honest. And I said, you know, I was like, you don't really diagnose people that much with ME, do you? And he said, well, you know, first of all, he said it was a very old fashioned diagnosis. And then he said, the best that can be said is that there are sufficient numbers of people demonstrating similar symptoms to make it of note.
Right.
So that's as far as he would go whenever he was talking about ME, which didn't really give me that much heart.
I can understand that actually. It's a little too vague for my liking, I think.
Yeah.
And as I say, I don't think there is one illness.
No.
I'm pretty sure it's not. For a start, that I can do things physically which many patients with ME can't. But I can't do things. I can't handle social situations. More than one, two people, I just go ahead. As soon as people start asking me questions, no, go away. I can feel my brain trying to make these connections inside, and it can't do it. And it gets very overloaded very quickly with any information. So. I just can't handle things like that. And I know that some people with ME are better than that, at that than me. From listening to what they do with their lives and everything, how they get on with people. So there isn't just one illness, I'm pretty sure of that.
I can massively identify with you talking about that, the social situation. It brings me out in a panic. I think for me, social situations, and I have the same response as well to travel. I was tweeting about travel just earlier. Public transport, I cannot go near at the moment. And some of my worst crashes have happened as a result of having to look up at a train board and work out where I'm meant to go next. And for some reason, that's a massive trigger for me. Like you describe your social situations, that for me just spins me completely out of control. And I cannot process it.
Processing, that's the word I use. I can't process the information. That's exactly what it is. And I can't watch videos online. I just, no, go away. I can't do that. If it's a transcript, I can. I can read a couple of paragraphs and then go back to it and read a couple of paragraphs. And I have two ways of reading as well. There's a sort of skim reading, which I use most of the time. And then there's a sort of more detailed reading. And the more detailed reading really takes it out of me. And I can only do that in very short bursts. But it's the information. I can't process it. I can't take it in. There's two things. One is that when there are people in the room and everything, my brain feels overloaded that it can't process what's going on. And the other thing then is actually processing the information which is coming to your head. My memory is shot. Absolutely. There are certain things I can do and I can't do. I have no creative ability at all. I can't draw, I can't dance, I can't hold a tune, I'm almost tone deaf. But I've always been quite good at mental arithmetic. I've always had quite a good memory. I've had a great memory for faces and things like that, and that's all gone. I've got none of that at all. I just can't take it in.
Wow. And do you, whenever you say that it's gone, do you hold out hope that it will come back? Do you have moments whenever you can be more... cognitively active than other moments, or do you think you have hit a new baseline that is the new normal for you?
Now this is interesting. This is the other way I think I'm different from other people, is that my illness has always recovered. I've always been recovering from my illness until I get another virus and I get set back and everything, or until I get another virus and I get another bout of ME or whatever. I'm not quite sure which is which, but I couldn't have existed all this time without the fact that whenever I have a period without a virus, I recover. I start recovering very, very slowly, but I do recover. Well, not okay. Recover is the wrong word. I see improvement in my condition over time. Right. I do see that. And it's the same when I had this virus back in January 2016. I'm better now than I was then, but I'm still not back to January 2017. I'm still not back to where I was in December 2016.
Wow.
Now, within that, it's important to say that I go through phases. So I go through a bad phase. I go through a phase, this is a bit personal, where I become obsessed with sex. I go through a phase where I depress, and I go through a phase where I feel a bit hyper, and it sort of goes through a cycle. At the end of the cycle, I'm a little bit better, and I can look back and I say, yeah, I'm a bit better than I was. So that's how it is with me.
I mean, we're really talking about, I know, and we'll talk about the ME-CFS differentiation in a second, but if that C ever meant anything, I mean, you're just talking about a virus you got, 2 years ago, and you're talking about you're beginning to recover from it. That is chronic to a T, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Well, it's interesting this, because I was talking about ME with a doctor in the late 80s, right? So I first got ill, December 85. So this was around about, it was the summer of 1988. And I was talking to a doctor in France, and he was a country GP. And I explained the illness. And he said, a slow virus. He knew the illness. And he knew the slow virus. And I thought I've always thought that was quite an interesting name for it.
That's brilliant.
And it does feel as though the last 2 years, I've been going through the normal cycle of recovery from a virus, except very, very slowly. So that, just over a year ago now, I had intense pain in my ears, for example. And my ears just filled up with wax. It was so bad, I got a slight infection. I had to go and see the doctor. Right? And now I'm getting this pain in my eyes from it. And these are all symptoms which you normally go through within a couple of weeks or something if you were in normal health. But it's been sort of spread over these last, over 2 years. But it's very odd. And the doctors don't believe me when you say this. I had a virus. This was going back to 2015, and I got it in the March. I think it was 2015. It was 14 or 15. It was 14 actually. Yeah, I got it in the March, and I told people that I had this. People online, everything, nothing to do with ME. I got this virus, and they say, you should go and see a doctor. This has taken a long time though, because of the ME. You should go and see a doctor. And eventually, after 6 months, I thought, right, I'd better go and see the doctor, because one, it's gone on for 6 months, and two, if the DWP say to me, are you doing the best you can to get better? And I say, no, I got a virus. And they say, well, have you seen a doctor about it? And I say, no, they could get antsy. So I thought, well, I better go and see the doctor. And she didn't believe me. Are you sure it's not your sinuses? And then sometimes it is in the sinuses. And I say, no, I'm ill, I got it. And anyway, so I previously got on okay with her. And then at the end, we were obviously getting nowhere. And so we kind of passed that. And I said, well, oh, by the way, I've got something else. And you better have a look at it. I've got these purple patches all over my body. And she said, well, let's have a look. So I pulled up and she goes, that's rosacea. Oh, yes, you do get that with the respiratory viruses, which I didn't know. And she suddenly changed. She suddenly thought, well, maybe I'm not talking nonsense. but it was sort of 6 months after I'd originally got it. You know, it's amazing.
There is such a struggle, I think. The most things that I think we read online, and you mentioned there the DWP, the Department for Work and Pensions in the United Kingdom, and a lot of the stuff, a lot of the fear, a lot of the anxiety, a lot of the anger that we read about online in our little corner of the Twitterverse is centered around doctors and the Department for Work and Pensions who provide support or benefits financially for those who are unable to work due to illness. That seems to be I find talk more about their anger about doctors and that particular government department than they do about the illness itself.
Yeah, there's no question that the people who promoted the CBT, okay, cognitive behavioral therapy, graded exercise therapy approach to this illness, who renamed it as chronic fatigue syndrome, who have convinced the medical profession and in the government that this is an illness that can be treated with these things, there is no doubt that they have poisoned the well greatly. No doubt about that, because I saw my GP in 1986. He was mid-50s, worked in the community all the time. Look, Swansea's not a medical hotbed, you know. He wasn't at the cutting edge. But he knew about this illness, right? He said, oh, yes, right. I've seen this before. And he said this unprompted. I've seen this before. I've seen patients with this before. And he knew pretty much what it was and how to treat it. And as I say, he called it post-viral syndrome. He didn't call it anything. But he knew about it. And after a year, and probably behind the scenes pressure from my parents, he suggested I go and see a physician in Swansea, a consultant physician, just to confirm the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, it was a man in his mid-50s, and he said, again, unprompted, I've seen this before. And again, he knew about the symptoms, and he knew that there was no treatment, and he knew that you had to leave it up to the patient to encourage them to do as much as they possibly could, but not to overdo it. And those people who knew about it then, and you go back to the doctors in the 90s and the zeros and now, and the doctors are far more hostile. They're far more questioning. They're far more doubtful. They're far less willing to listen to you than those doctors were in the mid-80s. And there's no question that is the impact of what these people have done. And it's one of the impacts that they've had. They've completely poisoned the relationship between the doctor and the patient.
So tell me a little bit about this. I remember whenever, and I've talked to, I think, everybody who's come on actually so far who has this illness, we've talked about that moment you get diagnosed and whether it was, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago or less than 10 years ago for me. You get the diagnosis. So after years of illness, finally you have a name. So you can, you know, you can name your enemy. You can get to know it. And obviously, like any common sense normal person, you get a diagnosis, you've got a name for it. The next question is, all right, so what do we do? And like everybody else that I've spoken to, I was referred to CBT and graded exercise therapy, you know? And at the time, you don't know, well, if it's a doctor telling you this is what you do, of course, I'm going to listen to the doctor and I'm going to follow through those things in the hope that, great, I was really ill for a decade. Now I know what my illness is called. Plus, I know what to do about it. Success, hope, fantastic. I'm still here, still sick. So obviously, it didn't work for me. But I think a lot of people feel quite strongly about graded exercise therapy, the CBT, the PACE trials. So where do you stand on this? Why don't you take us through your thoughts on this?
Okay, well, first of all, that as I said, your experience is different from mine because I was diagnosed in 1986 with this post-viral syndrome, and there was never any suggestion that I should seek sort of psychotherapy or there was nothing like that at all. And also that the diagnosis came quite quickly compared to other people. You know, it was a virus, and then it was post-viral syndrome. So I didn't go through that sort of that train of events that you described there. That was, it was just not my experience. The interesting thing is, all right, first is that the GP did refer me to somebody, but it was a consultant physician. It wasn't a consultant psychiatrist. And the GP never questioned it. He never, ever said anything like that at all. Now, interestingly, in 1987, I bumped into somebody and he said, oh yeah, I've got that illness or I have that illness. You've got to go and see this doctor. You've got to go and see her. She got me right. She just gave me some pills. It was great. So I thought, well, you know, I'll go along and try it. And it turned out it was a psychiatrist. So then she started asking me all these questions. I don't know what it is about psychiatrists. They have this thing about whether you like to go to supermarkets or not. I don't know. It was things like that, you know. Do you like going into shops, or do you like going into supermarkets, or I don't know? It was all these sorts of questions, and I just thought, oh, look, for goodness sake, let's just get on. But what are you asking me these silly questions for? Just give me the pills, and I'll go. And she gave me some antidepressants, as it turned out. And she said, right, now you've got to go for a run. So I said, well, okay, right. I'm game for that. Give me my running shoes. So I'm out there. This is what I want, you know?
Yeah. So
took these antidepressants and started to go and trying to go for runs. And it really messed me up. I mean, these antidepressants really screwed in my head. It was a really horrible, terrible experience. Awful. So I stopped. And the running was not clearly not the right thing, so I stopped that. And happily, because it was a referral I made myself and not one the GP made, I just wrote to Len and say thanks very much, bye, you know. And that was the end of that. So that has been my experience. It's very different, as I say. I think these people poisoned with the way this particular model has dominated medical thinking over the last 25 years, and that is one of the something which can be laying at their door. They've done a really bad thing. I think one of the worst things is that it's making a patient an unreliable witness to their own body. And that's a terrible thing, and it means that their friends, their family, the people they would normally support, their doctors, they look at them differently, and that is impossible to escape. It's going to do that. If you're told that you're, in my case, 30-year-old son, this is going back a while, who's slumping morosely around the house, who's not saying hello to anybody, who's just sitting there on the TV, sleeping or staying in bed all morning, getting up, watching TV, going to bed, not taking part in family life at all. And if you find out, and if you're then told that this person is behaving that way and has the ability within him to get better, who can change the way he thinks, who can increase his activity levels and so recover. If you're told that by the medical profession, you're going to look at him differently anyway. You're going to look at him differently. It's unavoidable. And so it's creating this barrier between the patient and the people that the patient would normally look to for support. I think that's one of the most horrible things. And as I say, it's making them unreliable witnesses so that everybody's opinion is better than the patient's. The patient doesn't know what's best for them, so you can come along and tell them. And I think that's just terrible. It's really deeply painful and hurtful. I think that's a horrible thing to do. I don't know whether you want me to talk further about the trial itself or...
Yeah, I mean, that was heartbreakingly familiar and amazingly eloquently put. I really identified with what you just said there. That's so very true. I think that I personally, and I think a lot of people, not only do they have to deal with this illness, but there is such guilt associated with it that every day one isn't back to your old self, one is failing, you know?
I don't, Paddy, because I've never, ever, ever felt guilty. I've never felt that. The problem has been that others have looked at me differently. And I've never felt that I needed to apologize to anyone. I've never felt guilty at all. And I feel very strongly about that. I can look myself in the mirror. And even though I've been ill for 30, since December 1985, since 33 years now, I can look at myself in the mirror and I know that I've done everything possible to get better at every possible moment, that I've lived every day, every minute of every day at the maximum of my capability. And because of that, I don't feel guilty. And I don't feel guilty at all. And I never have. And I don't feel guilty for the way I behave. I don't feel guilty of anything at all because I've had a terrible, awful illness. And the people who should feel guilty in my eyes, and firstly the people who promoted this perverse, terrible model based on no evidence whatsoever, and two, the people who've been bought into it and who haven't trusted me. Because I've had friends right from the beginning who said, look, I know John, I know that if he's like that, he's got to be very ill. And I also know people quite close to me who've looked at me and said, you know, why are you being so precious? At least you can make an effort. I don't feel guilty that I've cut those people out of my life. I feel very strongly about this. And as you can probably hear from my voice, quite emotionally about it, because there's people very close to me that I don't speak to. And it really, And I don't feel guilty about that, because it's they are the ones who are guilty, not me. I've had a terrible illness that has destroyed my life. It's taken everything from me. I've had no job. I've had no career. I haven't been able to take the sport for it. I've had no family. I'm alone, and I have no prospect really now, I think, at my age, of ever having a family. And it's a terrible, terrible thing to have a life unlived. And those people who haven't supported me right from the beginning, who didn't look at me and say, right, I know you, I'm on your side, whatever, they're the ones who have to feel guilty. And the people who've given the ammunition, the psychiatrists and psychologists who promoted this false model, they're the guilty ones. I'm not. I'm sorry, I know that's come on very strong, and I don't mean that aimed at you, Patty, but I do feel quite strongly about that, as you can tell.
Oh, preach, John, preach. Thank you so much. That's beautiful. That's strong. That's beautiful. And that's inspiring as well. I'm deeply, deeply grateful for what you just said. I think there'll be millions, thousands, hundreds, tens, one. There'll be people out there who just heard what you just said, and they will be wishing they could stand up out of their sofas and their beds and their chairs in solidarity with that. That's fantastic. That really is. And obviously, of course, one shouldn't feel guilty. You're absolutely right to say that. And that was powerful. Thank you very much.
Well, I think other people feel the same. If it's sort of given words to what they feel, maybe that will help a little bit.
I think it will. You can be sure of that. Would you like to talk a little bit more about the PACE trial? Because you mentioned it there, and I want to give you all the opportunity to share your thoughts as you can.
Well, the first thing I would say about this is I feel very grateful to people who've been working on the PACE trial, exposing its flaws right from the beginning. I know some of them. If I start naming them, I'm going to miss some people out. And some people think, well, why didn't you mention me? But I think we all know the ones who've been there, you know, going back over a decade, who've been saying this is wrong, and they've been pointing out the flaws. And I won't start naming, because I'll miss somebody out. But I am very, very grateful to them. And I've come to this very late, and I want to say that, because I know people have been exposing this for years, and I've had a bit of luck with some of the FOI requests, and I've sort of helped a little bit here and there, but it's been very late. I've been right to the, you know, at the end of the party, I've turned up. So I do want to say that. As for the trial itself, I'm trying to think about this. I was due to go to a hearing, a Freedom of Information request hearing in Swansea, in the tribunal hearing. Well, it was supposed to be last November, and then it was going to be in February, and then in the end, it was called off, and they've agreed to release the data if they can. And before that, I was trying to work out what had been going on, you know, why has this arisen? And I think it's quite complex. I think, and I'm not one of these people who says that these people set out to do harm. I've never really felt that. I'm not really into conspiracies, and I generally think that people set out with the best of intentions. But I think that something happened. I think they became the psychiatrists. We know the names of these people. The psychiatrists and psychologists who promoted this model became so attached to it, became so convinced they were right, that it blinded them. Became absolutely convinced that anyone who challenged them was not understanding the science. There was a slight area of superiority about it, I think, which is one of the things they could be guilty of. But they became absolutely convinced that they were right. And I think you see that in different ways, in the way they behaved, the way they dismissed criticisms from the patient charities and things like the ME Association. I know the Acts for ME backed them up in the end, but the ME Association thing, from individual patients, they dismissed these because they become absolutely convinced that they were right and everybody else was wrong. And I think you see this in their response to the actigraphy. We looked at the minutes of the management committees, and we saw that they dismissed using the actigraphy, the actimeters, at the end of the trial, because the readings didn't confirm the subjective improvement. And I think that's a massive giveaway, because it reveals straight off that they'd become so convinced that they were right, that if any evidence didn't fit, it was the evidence that was wrong. And then when they got to the end of the trial, when they began to understand that their outcome measures as originally set out weren't being met, that the definitions that they used weren't being met, they just decided that, well, if the definitions aren't being met, then it's clear that the definitions are wrong, the thresholds are wrong, because the theory is so right, because they were so convinced they were right. So they changed the thresholds. And we see that again in Sharpe's response to the analysis done by Carolyn Wilshire, Tom Kinman, Alan Matisse, and others. Again, I've forgotten some names. Sorry to those I forgot their names. Michael Sharpe's response this week, or was it last week, to the reanalysis repeats that. They changed the thresholds because they changed them to match what they were expecting to find. And I think that's a real massive giveaway. That gives an insight into their mentality, into their approach, into the utter conviction that they were right. And therein, of course, is the massive flaw in the trial and why it just doesn't provide the evidence for these approaches, which they claim it does. That's what kind of, I don't know how much more you want me to get into it, but that's a few thoughts.
I think that's super useful. Where would you recommend if somebody wanted to do their own independent research into this, if they wanted to read further about what you're talking about, where would you direct people to?
There have been so many good articles on this. I think one very good starting point is the Science for AME forum, and they've done a briefing, and they have a, believe in that briefing, there are links to others. So there's the Dave Tuller expose, there's the reanalysis done by Karen and Tom and Alan and others. There's a recent blog by Hilda Bastian, which is a blog post, which is very interesting. Again, if I start naming Julia Raymer, I can't remember which one it is, did a great article. And she did one in, which was published in the New York Times with Dave Tuller. So there's a lot of good stuff out there. Science for ME Forum is a good place to start and can ask there for more information.
That's fantastic. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So if you're listening to this, scroll down to the show notes and you'll be able to find a link to the Science for ME page, which, yes, I've checked it out myself and been in touch with quite a few of the people from Science for ME. And I hope in the future to have some of them on the show as well to share their experience as well. I guess on the back of all that, John, and what you said earlier, it's a question that I ask everybody who comes on towards the end. Do you have hope?
Yeah, I do. I have, as I say, it's a little bit easier for me because over time I do see this improvement, albeit small. And it's a hope that's diminishing, I have to say. I mean, you know, you go back and I lived through those years through my 30s and 40s, right into my 50s, you know, planning what I was going to do when I was going to get better. I was going to do this, I was going to do that. Okay, all right, I can't do this, I can't do that anymore. So I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. There's a way forward. There was something that at the end of it all I was going to be able to do. I don't know. I'm beginning to doubt that now at my age. Yeah, it's the options start closing in pretty rapidly. But it's the only thing that keeps me going is that one day perhaps my head will clear. I mean, that's the thing that I've wanted since waking up on that Tuesday, 10th of December, 1985. I just want to clear my head. I just want to clear my head. That's all I want, really. I mean, for me, that's what the illness is. The rest I can put up with, you know, everything else. But I just want to clear my head just for once. I don't know. It's like, you know, that's just as people have compared it to a massive hangover. It is like that. It's just, I just want this fog to clear, just to be in this world, you know, just after all this time, just to be in this world, to experience the world firsthand, because it does feel as though everything comes to me secondhand. Everything I experience is secondhand. I just want my head to clear, and I just cling on to the hope that At some point it will, but I don't know whether it will now. I don't know.
John, I don't know anybody who has summed it up as passionately, emotionally, and identifiably as that. I hope your head clears as well. I really do.
Thanks, buddy. And everybody else is out there, you know.
May all our heads clear, man. Yeah.
it's a new Irish toast, is it, buddy?
This is the new Irish toast. This is the new Celtic toast. Yeah. May your head be clear and your stride be long.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. It's something, anyway.
It's something, my brother. It's something. Yeah, it's well, listen, if people want to get in touch with you, if you want them to, how would people, how do you exist in the virtual world and in the internet space and the corners of the Twitterverse?
Well, I'm John the Jack, Swansea Jack, that's the thing. It's the name given to people from Swansea Jacks, as opposed to Fleshly Turks. And also the name of a famous dog, Swansea Jack the dog. So I'm John the Jack, and I use the same handle everywhere. And I'm normally found on Twitter, as some people know. Put in the world to rights. #C4 News.
Yeah, I think we're gonna have to come. You're gonna have to come on again, I think, and we'll have to do a whole extra show on the politics and everything else because.
I think people have had enough politics the last couple of years.
Gracious, yes.
by all means.
That'll be wonderful. Well, listen, John. Again, you've given. I'm so grateful for everybody who comes on, but you've just given me so much food for thought, so much inspiration. I will certainly definitely reflect on what you said about guilt. I think that that is something that a lot of people will take a lot from. So thank you so much for that. And thank you very much for being a presence out there, fighting for us. And representing us at times as well. I remember actually I direct messaged you whenever the debate happened in the UK Parliament about whenever they were talking about ME, and I've got a feeling that yours was one of the names mentioned by your local MP.
Yes, actually not even my MP, but someone I've got in contact with. Yes, I'm very grateful for that. I really do want to say thank you very much to Ben Lake, the MP who mentioned me in the debate. He's not actually my MP, but he's somebody who has, for a long time, along with others like Carol Monaghan and Nicky Morgan and Edward Davey, and I'm going to forget Stephen Pound and others I'm going to forget. But I do want to say thank you to Ben Lake for mentioning me in that debate. It was very good of him.
Well, I'll make sure we tag him in the whenever we post the show as well, so he knows that you've said that. Yeah, it was a special. I remember that debate because it was so cool to hear so many names mentioned that I only knew through Twitter. I felt very, very proud of our little community on that day, I have to say.
Yeah, it was an important moment, I think.
Yeah.
A big step forward, and it's good to hear the names as well.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you so much for coming on.
Paddy, it's been a great pleasure to meet you, see you. Well, meet you online anyway. Good to you and have a chat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And yeah, very good. Thanks very much.
You're more than welcome. And I'm sure we will have you on again. I think this is going to go down as quite a popular show. So until next time, John, I'll see you on Twitter.
Okay. Cheerio, Paddy.
Cheers.
And back to just me. I don't think I really have the words. I'm really grateful for John coming on. As I said, he was meant to be the first ever guest, and you can absolutely hear why. I think he represented himself and the illness fantastically well. His words will stay with me a very long time, and no joke, I will definitely be encouraging him to come back in the near future to share some more experience. He demonstrated exactly what I hope for this show, that people can come on and feel they have the opportunity to share what John clearly stated himself, his own experience, just his experience, but he shared it in a strong, powerful, emotional, and thorough way. So John, thank you so much for coming on. We will have you on again in the near future. I'm not going to hang around too much today because this has been quite a long episode. We could have gone longer with John, which is why I will have him back again in the future. If you would like to come on the show, and I really hope you do, like I said, the way I see it is, you know, if you're connected to this illness, then you're in a queue. And if you want to get to the front of the queue, all it takes is a DM or an email. You can find me on Twitter at @ZeroAllAboutMe, or email at itsreallynotallaboutme@gmail.com, and both of those are in the show notes below, along with any links that John mentioned and his Twitter as well. So that's it for this week. I hope you've had a good week. I've had a pretty decent week, I have to say. You know, I didn't actually achieve, sorry, that's the wrong term, thinking of achievement. I didn't get much done, but I don't feel the worse for it. And that kind of makes sense to me, and I kind of feel good about that. I'm recording this on a Friday evening, before it comes out to you on a Monday. And I'm actually, you know, I've got enough energy from resting all week to maybe go out to dinner tonight with Maggie. So that's something to be incredibly grateful for. It really is. Next week, we're going to have a chat, that promised chat from last week, about is it ME or is it CFS? What's the difference and what do they mean? And also, I thought maybe have a reflection and an exploration on the response to the question, how are you doing, from people outside of the ME world. How are you doing? That's a question I get, you know, periodically from family members on a WhatsApp or a text, or friends who maybe don't, you know, live, you know, on a small ocean away. How are you doing? How do you answer that? I thought we might reflect on that. So that's coming up next week. If you've got any thoughts on that ahead of time, please DM me, get in touch, tweet me. @ZeroAllAboutMe. And, you know, tell me your thoughts and we'll add that to the discussion. So, yeah, MECFS, what's that? What's the difference? What do you identify as having? How do you get to that conclusion? If you've got thoughts on that, get in touch with me. And also, how do you answer the question, how are you doing? What is the answer to that? You know, we'll talk about that. I think that's going to be a good one. We'll talk about that next week. But for now, until then, have the best day that you possibly can. Take care of yourself and each other. Cheers. I've been Paddy. Bye.